The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated September 26/October 3, 2022. It has an unusual edge rather than the bright red with the white inner border. The border is gray with the white inner border. Then the background is gradations of blue from a pale aqua to a chalkier gray-blue. Time, as usual, is superimposed in large block letters in off-white to light gray. The caption on the front cover reads, "The Queen." It is Elizabeth II, 1926 to 2022. The Queen is enrobed in a black robe, possibly the robe of the garter, but she wears no insignia. Instead, there are four large buttons, gold-colored, with two more and a chain at the very top by the collar that is upturned. She wears her typical white pearl earrings with a small diamond. We see her in partial profile. She's looking askance from the camera. Her hair is dark chestnut brown, her eyes light blue, I would say. She's smiling tentatively. This is a Cecil Beaton portrait. No date. We'll begin with the view, Health, When to Boost, by Michael Daniel and Monica Gandhi. The promise of the mRNA vaccine technology platform was always that we could update shots quickly. With the approval by the FDA and CDC of bivalent vaccines, we may finally have an advantage over COVID-19. The updated vaccine recipe matches the current dominant circulating BA.4/BA.5 strains, with no other highly transmissible variant of concern yet on the horizon. However, we are concerned the CDC may again be missing the boat with its recommendations on when most American adults should receive this booster. The CDC stated that adults who completed their primary vaccine series are eligible for the updated booster if it has been at least 2 months since their previous vaccine. Separately, they advise those who had an infection to wait 3 months before getting boosted. Such a short interval is not optimal if we're aiming for robust fall and winter-long protection, and could even be counterproductive. The CDC should recommend a 6-month interval between a previous booster or infection and the new updated vaccine for healthy adults for two primary reasons: updated immunologic studies and recognition that millions of Americans had post-vaccination infections with Omicron variants this year and thereby have strong current protection against reinfection with BA.5. We previously called on the CDC to extend the recommended interval between primary doses of both mRNA vaccines to 8 weeks, primarily on the basis of immunologic studies demonstrating a high antibody response, amplified T cells, and enriched memory B cells with a longer time between doses. Recent research studies during the Omicron variant era continue to demonstrate the benefit of an extended interval between doses, in terms of increasing both neutralizing antibodies and memory B cells. A booster provides antibody protection for at least 6 months, according to a recent study. Another study demonstrated antibody levels stabilized 6 to 9 months post-vaccination for those both with and without previous infection. Memory B cells were even more robust after vaccination, demonstrating maintained reactivity against all variants, including Omicron, for at least 9 to 10 months after the primary two-dose series, with an additional positive response to a third-dose booster. Another study showed memory B cells continue to mature for approximately 6 months after vaccination or infection. B cell immunity, as well as T cell immunity to COVID vaccines, provided protection against severe illness and did not lead to high level of hospitalization, as BA.5 became dominant this summer. One of the aims of the Omicron-specific vaccines is to increase antibodies and prevent even mild infections. The antibody level plateau at the 6-month mark would thus signal an ideal time to boost with a BA.4/5 focused vaccine. Since a low pre-booster antibody level actually correlated with a greater increase post-boosting. To put it another way, high levels of circulating antibodies from short-interval boosting may limit the added protection of another booster. Another recent study by the NIH showed giving a booster 2 months after a recent infection actually abrogates effective B cell responses. A study in JAMA showed 56% of people who were infected with the Omicron variant were unaware of the infection. And the actual number of daily infections this past summer vastly exceeded the official tabulation. In addition, millions of Americans have received their third and fourth vaccine doses in the past few months. The benefit of this degree of population immunity can be extrapolated from a recent study out of Portugal that shows, contrary to previous concerns for BA.5 reinfection, that infection from earlier Omicron strains, BA.1/2, provides upwards of 75.3% protection against reinfection with BA.5. All this data means there's a high amount of active population-level immunity to COVID-19 in the U.S. that is protective against severe disease. Our booster strategy should recognize this existing immunity and seek to build upon it in a manner that prolongs the protection of the new shot through the winter. Short-interval repeat boosting or boosting too soon after a post-vaccination infection will limit the neutralizing antibody response and could stunt the expansion of memory B cells. It is imperative to increase trust in public health by emphasizing protecting those most at risk of severe breakthroughs, that is, older people and those who are immunocompromised. Only half of eligible Americans got the first booster dose. It is absolutely critical that we get the timing right for the Omicron booster. Regarding the authors of this article, Dinah is an emergency physician at Providence St. Joseph Medical Center in Burbank, California. Gandhi is a professor of medicine and physician at San Francisco General Hospital. Michael Daniel and Monica Gandhi wrote the article. The risk report by Ion Bremmer, A Dangerous War in Ukraine Grows More Uncertain. In Ukraine, the tables have turned. In the province that surrounds Kharkiv, Ukraine launched a major counteroffensive, and thousands of Russian soldiers retreated. As of September 14, Ukraine has regained more territory than Russia has captured in months, and the mood of its political and military leaders has turned dramatically upbeat. Russian artillery attacks that knocked out power and water in much of the Kharkiv region have done little to dampen the mood, just as Ukraine demonstrated in the war's early weeks that Russians' victory plans were pure delusion. Its latest gains again make clear Vladimir Putin's war refuses to go to plan. Importantly, they show Ukraine's backers in America and Europe, and that its war effort remains an investment that offers returns. Ukrainian fighters have used Western weapons and training in how to use, protect, and maintain them to push Russian forces onto the back foot in different parts of the country. Here the timing's crucial. An expected tough winter in Europe, created in part by an energy crisis fueled by the war, is expected to test European public patience with costly support for Kyiv. Inside Russia, the mood continues to sour. Criticism of battlefield failures remains safely directed at Russia's Defense Department, not at the president, who pushed the generals into a war they were ill-prepared to wage. Complaints from Russian nationalists have grown louder. Yet Ukraine's latest success is unlikely to shorten the war. Russian forces still have a firm grip on much of the Donbas region and on land seized along the Black Sea coast. More worrisome, Ukraine's advance may also make the war more dangerous. Putin now finds himself in a tough spot, and that should worry those who fear expansion of the war. Russia's president has shown no sign during his political life that he will admit a mistake and reverse course. And although he insists Russia is at war with the West, he has avoided changing the rules of engagement to widen the conflict. His government continues to threaten any Russian who describes the war as a war with 15 years in prison, and he has refused the demands of Russian online hawks to order a draft that would force hundreds of thousands of Russian civilians to grab a rifle. Perhaps he fears conscription would dramatically shift Russian public opinion against his special military operation. Or perhaps he knows that, given the need to train and equip all these new soldiers, a large-scale draft is too little too late to force an end to the stalemate in Ukraine. This leaves the West to worry that Putin, like the famous rat he trapped as a child that chose to fight once backed into a corner, will turn to weapons of mass destruction. Ukraine's gains have shifted the stalemate, but the end of the war remains out of reach. The Leadership Brief by Belinda Luscombe, Editor-at-Large. It looks like this is a question-and-answer style column with three questions and answers. Dallas Mavericks CEO Cynthia Sint Marshall is the first black woman to head up an NBA team. Question, in the book, you've been chosen. You write your father said you'd end up on the street. How much of your life has been driven by proving him wrong? Maybe that's supposed to be how much of your life has been driven by proving him wrong. Answer, I did prove him wrong, but I think it was more driven by a sense of purpose. There was a time when three things... Him threatening me the night of my graduation, him coming through my window with a shotgun, and him coming up to us in a parking lot with a gun, would play in my mind all the time, back to back, to the point where I just had to pray. I don't know when, but I realized I wasn't thinking about those things anymore. I was getting on with life. Question. You write about being treated as untrustworthy as a black woman in corporate America. Has that decreased over time? Answer. As I got bigger jobs, I think it probably increased. The more I was responsible for, the more scrutiny I got. The more people you have to deal with, the more they are looking at every move you make. I'm used to it. Question. What did you do to address the Mavericks' toxic workplace culture when you arrived? Answer. My recipe is to lay out a vision for where we want to take the organization. Lay out a set of values if they don't already exist. If they do exist, do an assessment on them, and then spend time one-on-one with people. Come up with a plan and a workplace promise. At the Mavs, our promise is every voice matters and everybody belongs. Our values are character, respect, authenticity, fairness, teamwork, and safety. The D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. When Barack and Michelle Obama returned to the White House September 7 for their first joint visit since leaving office in early 2017, official Washington revived the mythical contours of the congenial relationship the former president enjoyed with the current one. It was cute, for sure, but according to a new book from journalist Gabriel DeMenedetti, such a shorthand misses the complicated and nuanced relationship between Barack Obama and Joe Biden, two political figures who might represent the closest pairing of a president and vice president in history. Sure, it looked like a classic bromance from the outside, but no collaboration with so much at stake can be reduced to an easy sketch. De Benedetti's new book, The Long Alliance, The Imperfect Union of Joe Biden and Barack Obama, details a relationship that was messier than many realized. This is also a question and answer format from here on. Five questions and answers. Question. We just watched Biden unveil the Obamas' portraits, and a lot of us are going to shorthand that to a bromance, but is it? Answer. Beneath the surface, this relationship has had very serious ups and downs over time, both personal and especially political. They've known each other 20 years, and these are two men who come from very different worlds, have very different life experiences, and very different experiences in Washington. Question, how did they navigate that? Answer, it took a lot of time. Biden never went up once to the White House residence. How many times did they golf together, despite the fact they're both avid golfers? You can count on one hand. The reality is they bonded because the world was a very difficult place. The idea that they see the world the same way, that they're buddies who are just texting, having a great time together all the time, that's just not reality. Question. It seems like they were on completely different pages about how Washington worked. Answer. One thing that frustrates Biden to this day, and certainly people around him, is that it's easy to forget that obviously he's best known as the former vice president and now the president, but he's been in the Senate for 36 years. This was a man who really knew how Washington worked. Obama relied on him to help him navigate that for quite some time. Question. We saw that during the review of Afghanistan-Pakistan policy. For much of 2009, Biden was the naysayer in the room. But that was by design, right? Answer, that is right. Obama asked Biden to stretch the terms of debate. And sometimes that meant pressure testing every single thing the military leaders said. Sometimes that meant asking every single last question. Military leaders thought that there was nothing more annoying than having to deal with Biden. but Obama appreciated it. Question, when it comes to her time, will Vice President Kamala Harris be able to claim a similar relationship with Biden? Answer, they are just very different relationships. Biden sought a partner who, in his words, could be his Biden. Obama counseled him not to think in those terms. Biden may like Harris's instincts, but at the end of the day, she's not someone who has more experience than him, so he's not going to rely on her for advice in the same ways. There's no easier way to sum up the differences in their relationships than that Biden and Obama had weekly lunches. Harris and Biden started off having those weekly lunches, but how many times have they done it this year? 5 is my last count. This is 7 questions. It's a usual last page of the Time magazine. Today it's written by Eric Cortalesa, Mary Peltola, and that's spelled P-E-L-T-O-L-A, on being the first Alaska native elected to Congress, the limits of Sarah Palin, and the virtues of ranked choice ballots. It looks like 7 questions. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There's a photograph here of Mary Peltola. It's mostly her head and upper body. She has very long, very dark hair, dark eyes. She's smiling at the camera. She's wearing some jewelry. One earring is covered by her hair, but the other is a drop earring with 2 beads on it. She has white beads around her neck. She's wearing a white top underneath a plaid jacket. The photo's in black and white, so I can't describe coloration. Beginning then, what does it mean to you to be the first Alaska Native elected to Congress? Answer, I am very happy to see that Alaska Natives are getting a seat at the table, but I just really want to emphasize to the folks that I'm the representative for all Alaskans, regardless of their ethnic background or gender or religious affiliation. Question, as a Democrat, you won a crowded special election in August that included Sarah Palin. Many voters wrote you in as their second choice. What do you think this race revealed about the virtues of ranked choice voting? Answer, I think that it reveals that there's an appetite for middle-of-the-road candidates. I think moving away from closed partisan primaries will help us elect fewer ideologues who are less entrenched and more capable of compromising, reaching consensus, and building coalitions. I think it shows such candidates are more palatable, even among those who may not have picked someone else as their first choice. That adds value as well. Question, Alaskans were obviously very familiar with Palin. What were her vulnerabilities in this race? Answer, although I like her, she can be a polarizing figure. We had a good working relationship. Her 2 years as governor coincided with my last 2 years in the State House, but her support was in the 30% range, and it was hard for her to get beyond that and tap into folks who are not her supporters. Question, are Alaskans tiring of Trump and his acolytes? Answer, I think that he does have a very strong base of support, and that is reflective of the fact that there's a universal feeling now of disenfranchisement, of being forgotten, of being ignored, and this now extends to Caucasians and men, and it is not something that should be dismissed. That is a real feeling. It did not come out of nowhere. I don't think there's any use in dismissing it. I think that anybody who has those feelings should be validated that those are authentic feelings. We should find a way to make sure everyone feels that they are being heard. Question. Alaska is a big hunting state. Would you support an assault weapons ban or universal background checks? These are major priorities of National Democrats. Answer, of course I support background checks. I do not think that that is an infringement on Second Amendment rights. I would like to see the particulars of an assault weapons ban because they are used in some instances in hunting in Alaska, and they are tied to food security. But right out of the gate, no, I do not support a complete ban on all assault rifles. Question, what was your relationship like with Republican Representative Don Young, your predecessor? Answer, my parents were friends with him. My dad taught school together with Don Young in Fort Yukon, a very small community on the Yukon River in the 1960s. They were really good friends. They were hunting buddies. They both had winter trap lines. They bought a bulldozer and took 12-hour shifts fighting a wildfire one summer. My dad does not have a lot of close friends, but Don was certainly one of his lifelong friends. When I went to school in Pennsylvania and was not able to get home for Thanksgiving, I was invited by Don to spend Thanksgiving with his family in Virginia. That was the first time I had ever spent Thanksgiving without my family. I have tremendous respect and admiration for Don and his 49 years of service to our state and his real commitment to our state and the people of our state. Question, what does it mean to you now to be filling his shoes as his successor? Answer, it's daunting. No one will ever be able to fill his shoes. This is from Time Off Television, a hard reboot of the sitcoms That Raised Us by Judy Berman. You've never seen Step Right Up, but trust me, you know it all too well. It's a Y2K-era sitcom about a couple co-parenting the wife's son with her ex, who also lives with them. It's Full House meets Step by Step with a dash of Two and a Half Men. There's slapstick and a laugh track. The characters are broad but lovable and eager to learn. The fact that the show does not exist has not stopped it from being revived in Reboot, a smart Hulu comedy that premiered September 20. Created by Stephen Levitin, Modern Family, Reboot is meta to the max. It opens with 30-something indie filmmaker Hannah, Rachel Bloom, pitching, yes, Hulu executives on an edgy Step Right Up sequel, starring original cast members played by Judy Greer and Keegan-Michael Key. You know how in the old sitcom the characters always did the right thing, she explains. They don't do the right thing anymore. Just as Hannah's vision starts to take shape, the execs drop a bombshell. Step Right Up's creator, Gordon, Paul Reiser, thinks her script is too dark and socially conscious and has returned to fix it. Now the world is just a mess, he tells the cast, and people need comfort. They don't want kale salad. Let's give them mac and cheese. As he and Hannah play tug of war in the writer's room, Reboot highlights the tension between a generation raised in the late 80s through the early aughts on artificially sunny family sitcoms and the elders who manufactured that false optimism. But the conflict is not solely intergenerational. The millennial characters are also working through their relationships with a show that played such an outsized role in their childhoods. Reboot is hardly the first series to get self-aware about TV's endless torrent of reboots, remakes, and remixes. But what it does so insightfully, and without spoiling the fun, is to frame that industry trend within a present where the cheerful family sitcoms of two or three decades ago have proved to be pure fantasy. The show suggests why so many viewers, millennials in particular, are so eager to revisit old favorites, and also why those revivals rarely work. Nostalgia for a world that never existed can never be satisfied. It is hard to say when TV's recycling mania began in earnest, but streaming supercharged the trend. starting with Netflix's 2013 revival of Arrested Development, technically a family sitcom, but one whose absurdist humor would be lost on the elementary school set. The next year, Disney Channel made 90s Boy Meets World Sweethearts, Corey and Topanga, the parents of Girl Meets World's titular tween. Since then, platforms have made a practice of plucking wholesome family comedies whose rights they control from the purgatory of after-school syndication. More often than not, these comebacks have been straightforward attempts to recreate the comforting vibes of the original series. Netflix's 2016 Full House sequel, Fuller House, moved the Tanner girls back into their famously overstuffed childhood home and slotted them into versions of the tripartite parental roles once played by Bob Saget, John Stamos, and Dave Coulier. Updated with a few non-white cast members and some jokes about social media, its tone, optimistic to the point of delusion, could have come straight out of ABC's bygone TGIF lineup. At first, Fuller House was a hit that seemed to justify Netflix's investment in millennial nostalgia content. Although it would last a solid 5 seasons, likely because it aired at a time when Netflix rarely canceled its originals, viewership reportedly dropped off by 52% between seasons 1 and 2. Meanwhile, Full House creator Jeff Franklin's ouster, after a misconduct investigation, casts the franchise's gentle, didactic voice in a more cynical light. In 2021, a similarly straight-faced sequel to 80s plucky orphan comedy Punky Brewster had the distinction of becoming the first half-hour sitcom canceled by Peacock. The problem with these shows was that they existed in a time warp. American society at the end of the last century was no utopia, but it was an upbeat enough era that family entertainment could get away with twee depictions of domestic life. A generation later, these love fests rang false to every kind of viewer. They were not for parents raised on the Tanners, who had spent adult lives plagued by economical and political flux binging Game of Thrones. And they were not for kids growing up with school shootings, global warming, and a pandemic in an internet-poisoned culture defined by nastiness. Didn't it just figure ABC's 2017 Roseanne revival had to kill off its lead and become the Conners after the real Roseanne shot her mouth off on Twitter? In recent years, streamers have begun to acknowledge changing times with irreverent revivals, yielding slightly better results. Peacock's 2020 remix of Saved by the Bell from millennial creator Tracy Wakefield added working-class kids, a Trumpian heel turn for Zach Morris, and a much-needed sense of irony. But jokes at the expense of the original series got old fast, and it was canceled after 2 seasons. Now it remains to be seen whether Bel Air, a gritty teen drama reboot of The Fresh Prince of Bel Air that premiered this year, will survive past Peacock's initial 2-season order. Television's family comedy nostalgia has, by my count, yielded 2 masterpieces, neither of which is an extension of an established brand. Too Many Cooks, the viral 2014 Adult Swim short, spun a hokey Full House-style opening credits sequence into a delirious send-up of late 20th century TV that succinctly surveys its hundreds of nonsensical tropes. More poignant was Netflix's BoJack Horseman, an animated dramedy about a vice-riddled anthropomorphic horse who had starred in a 90s sitcom, Horsin' Around, as the surrogate dad to three human orphans. In a monologue that reboots Mac and Cheese analogy echoes, BoJack explains the appeals of shows like this. After a hard day in the real world, people want to watch something where no matter what happens, at the end of 30 minutes, everything's going to turn out okay. But what if those fictions only set up audiences for a lifetime of disappointment? As BoJack spent 6 seasons wrestling with addiction, depression, and childhood trauma, his long family sitcom Hangover felt like a magnification of our own. Despite their considerable differences in tone, BoJack and Reboot are both interested in wholesome family sitcoms' relationship to the experience of growing up in a real, imperfect family. In one scene, Elaine, Krista Marie Yu, a young executive, confesses, "When I was a kid, my parents worked all the time, and I was usually home alone studying and watching TV shows about families that always seemed happier than mine." Hannah has plenty of her own wounds wrapped in the show, and instead of offering viewers the empty comforts of a fake world made right within half an hour, her priority is the truth. To the extent that such a standard can be applied to fictional characters. She wants to hold them accountable for their sometimes indefensible actions and to see the grim realities of 2022 acknowledged within their cozy living room set. This is how she hopes to reconcile childhood fantasies with a long history of disappointment. BoJack took a dim view of such efforts. Modest personal change might be possible after decades of hard work, it allowed, but the damage of the past can never truly be undone. Reboot, an essentially optimistic comedy that exposes the artifice of other optimistic comedies, makes the case that kale and macaroni belong on the same plate. That Hannah and Gordon are better off collaborating across the generation gap. In one of the show's smartest touches, Gordon disrupts Hannah's diverse young writers' room by bringing in some politically incorrect veteran comedy writers. At first, it looks like the factions will go to war, yet through mutual good faith, they learn to work together and enjoy one another's company. I don't think Reboot's aim is to heal millennial trauma or mend a generational rift or teach some hugging and learning lesson. Rather, it challenges viewers' ambivalence toward the unrealistic shows that shaped us into a compelling blend of comedic sensibilities, new and old. Sappy sitcoms age poorly, but kindness is a classic. Amazon's Power Play, How Tech Giants Are Driving the Green Energy Revolution, by Andrew Blum. Blum is the author of Tubes and The Weather Machine. When Richard and Carson Harkrader first heard that 696 acres of North Carolina farmland had come up for sale in 2016, one feature of the rolling landscape particularly caught their attention: the power lines that sliced across it as though someone had dog-eared its map. Hard up against the Virginia border, it was a pretty spot, pretty enough that a home builder would eventually take a quarter of the acres for a lakefront subdivision. But for the Hark Raiders, father and daughter operators of Carolina Solar Energy, an independent developer of solar energy projects, the prettiest thing of all were those heavy-duty transmission lines that arced to the northwest, lacing into the PJM interconnection. The giant electric grid that dominates the mid-Atlantic. It was kind of a gold rush, the elder Harkrader says one morning this summer, standing amid the hundreds of thousands of glistening black panels, now known as Hawtree Creek Solar Farm, that follows the curve of the hills and tower over our heads. By mid-morning, the panels are sending 34 megawatts out to the grid, about the same as 10,000 backyard generators buzzing at once. By noon, it's 65 megawatts, the maximum the grid will take. I still think it's magic, Harkrader says. Take sunlight and boom. Except the only noise is the occasional creaking of their steel frames as small motors tilt the panels to follow the arc of the sun across the Carolina sky. About 200 miles north in Virginia are the eager buyers of that electric gold, the mega technology companies like Amazon, Microsoft, and Google that operate giant data centers essential to our daily lives, whether we're ordering on Prime or backing up family photos. Under pressure from customers, employees, and shareholders, and arguably out of their own eagerness to reduce emissions, they've been increasingly determined to run these data centers on renewable energy. Once the Harkraders had secured the new solar farm's preliminary permits and permissions, making a plan to accommodate local deer and joining the crowded interconnection queue to plug into the grid, they leased the land to Engie, that's spelled E-N-G-I-E, a French energy giant that builds and operates more than 4,500 megawatts of solar power around the world. And then, before the panels had even arrived on site for installation, Engie in turn struck a deal to sell all the site's power to a single company, Amazon. That financial and legal arrangement, known as a PPA, Power Purchase Agreement, has been a crucial force in the U.S.'s transition to clean energy. Of the approximately 235 gigawatts of wind and solar capacity now installed on the nation's grid, nearly one quarter, more than 52 gigawatts, has been contracted by corporations, mostly over the past decade. That vigorous and notably voluntary corporate action has boosted a web of wind and solar manufacturers, developers, and operators. It has made renewables cost competitive and helped grid operators learn to manage systems with more variability. As the modern mortgage made the suburbs, the PPA has made the renewables industry. It bridges the economic needs of renewable energy developers with the climate goals of corporate executives and shareholders. Solar panels and wind turbines are expensive to build but cheap to operate, given that their fuel, sunlight, and fresh air are free. By guaranteeing the electricity will be sold long before it's been generated, a PPA gives banks confidence to front the money for construction, especially when there's a giant corporation guaranteeing the deal. In the way that power grids work, all that electricity is not wired directly to these companies' facilities, but adds more juice to each region as a whole. But the way that PPAs work mean the companies can legitimately argue that these giant renewable projects would not have happened without them. PPAs stitch together developers like the Harkraders, energy operators like Engie, electric grids like PJM, and above all, the large companies hungry for power from renewable sources. They also set up the biggest corporate power purchase of all. Amazon has leveraged that ecosystem to go on the largest ever solar and wind shopping spree buying 15.7 gigawatts globally over the past 3 years, nearly equal to the prodigious energy demands of the $1.4 trillion company. Like an early shopper on Black Friday, Amazon's fervor has been felt across the industry, while also giving a glimpse of the incredible growth still to come, with the arrival of $369 billion in federal funds provided by the Inflation Reduction Act, IRA. Understanding this key driver of the past decade of solar and wind development helps us see what is likely to happen next, an unprecedented boom in renewable energy that could form a significant wedge in the broader effort to reduce carbon emissions and limit the warming of the atmosphere. If it was a market that only waited till something was built, then you went out and tried to sell the electricity, these projects wouldn't get done, says Harkrader. People like Amazon or Microsoft, Walmart, Target, on and on, are standing up and making this market possible, and it's exploding. These days, Amazon is the hungriest of all. The behemoth was not the first to buy renewable power for its operations, but it is now buying the most. The plan it has announced globally amounts to the equivalent of around 250 more Hawtrey Creeks, and more or less equal to all the solar generation built in the U.S. last year. The buying spree is part of Amazon's broader effort to reach net zero carbon by 2040, meaning it will eliminate or offset the carbon emissions from all its operations, including trucks, planes, and manufacturing. That will not be easy. An estimated two-thirds of American households are Amazon Prime members. It's almost impossible to use the internet without accessing an Amazon data center. Since it announced its climate goal in 2019, Amazon's emissions have grown 40%, as its sales have grown more than 50%. The path to achieving some of our goals will be long and complex, acknowledges Kara Hurst, who leads Amazon's sustainability efforts. But clean electricity is Amazon's climate bright spot. With today's technology and a fat checkbook, the company has nearly eliminated its use of dirty energy, prioritizing the hard realities of glass and steel over tree planting or tricky accounting, building at a scale that rivals that of many countries. Amazon has catapulted itself to the front ranks of corporate buyers, contracting last year for more than double its nearest competitor, Microsoft, for the past decade. In the absence of major climate legislation, and in the face of a complex patchwork of regulations that limited the ability of utility companies to build renewable power, PPAs have done the job. But the IRA, the most substantial piece of climate-focused legislation the U.S. has seen, takes that progress and adds billions of dollars in federal incentives. It supercharges both the role and the potential for customers to drive even more of this, says Bryn Baker, senior director at the Clean Energy Buyers Association. The latest predictions are gargantuan. Solar developers expect to install more than 215 gigawatts of capacity over the next 5 years, 40% more than was expected before the IRA, according to a report from the Solar Energy Industries Association and Wood Mackenzie. But electricity is only one segment of carbon emissions, meaning that alone will not be enough to meet the climate goals set by the Paris Agreement. The hope is that the paths established by renewable energy can be applied to harder to decarbonize segments like electric vehicles and manufacturing. Amazon, for instance, has announced plans for 100,000 electric delivery vehicles by 2030, I think we could see even faster progress on transportation than we have seen with clean energy on the grid, says Bill Weil, executive director of Climate Voice and a former director of sustainability at Facebook. In corporate renewable power purchasing, we can see the narrow path that will need to be expanded into a highway over the next decade. For the Hark Raiders, Hawtree Creek required years of close attention to bring to fruition, attending county planning meetings, mapping wetlands, and exploring an old cemetery that in the end could not be moved. The solar panels wrap around it. But for Charlie Daitch, who spearheads Amazon's renewable power purchasing, Hawtree was one row on a very tall spreadsheet. I have a pretty good map in my head of the portfolio. Where are we distributed? Maybe not each individual project, Daitch says from the passenger seat of a rented SUV, barreling across North Carolina on his first visit to the site. It's gotten bigger than that. When Amazon announced the Climate Pledge in 2019, it set its own target for reaching net zero carbon emissions by 2040, 10 years ahead of the Paris Agreement. It included in that was an earlier goal, use 100% renewable energy by 2030. For a company like Amazon, which has a sprawling infrastructure for moving goods around the world, eliminating emissions is a challenge that stretches across the business. Sustainable aviation fuel and heavy-duty electric trucks are still years, if not decades, away from broad adoption. But wind and solar power are ready now. Renewables is a place we identified where we could go fast to decarbonize our electricity stack, adds Daitch, a mechanical engineer by training. Compared with its competitors, Amazon came late to that realization. Walmart announced the first ever utility-scale PPA in 2008 with a 153-megawatt wind farm in Texas. At the time, it was a controversial move. Those early companies that made these commitments did not do so because customers were asking for it, says Miranda Ballantyne, who led Walmart's sustainability efforts at the time and is now CEO of the Clean Energy Buyers Association. The corporate winds shifted in 2010. That March, Greenpeace called out the technology companies for their energy use. Their report was perfectly timed, coming just days before the first iPad was released, a device that self-evidently depended on the Internet behind it. The tech companies went on the defensive. There is no such thing as a coal-powered data center, insisted Facebook in a statement. Every data center plugs into the grid offered by their utility or power provider. Dirty energy, in other words, was not their problem. It was the grid's problem. That half-shrug emoji of an argument did not last long. The next year, in a joint statement with Greenpeace, Facebook announced a new preference for clean and renewable energy. Over the next several years, the other tech giants lined up to follow suit. Putting solar panels on the roof or wind turbines in the parking lot was never going to be enough. Data centers require too much energy for that, often hundreds of megawatts each. Power purchase agreements give large corporations a way to use renewable energy without having to wait for utilities. Large off-site power purchase agreements remain the tool that allows you to move more quickly, says Aaron Decker, a consultant at Schneider Electric, one of the leading clean energy advisors. Big tech firms are happy to make long-term deals, especially if they can send out a press release. According to the logic of corporate climate action, if a solar farm is built in the desert, it needs to make a sound. Here's a photo It looks like a gas station with a lot of cords running from pumps to vehicles. The vehicles are all dark blue vans that say Amazon on the grill, and it's not a filling station. Well, it is a filling station, but it's Amazon EV trucks produced by Rivian Automotive charging at a logistics center in Chicago. So instead of filling her up, they're charging her up. Now, I'm going to skip through a portion of this lengthy article and end at about the last paragraph. For both corporations and individuals, all this comes back to the broadest goal of reducing emissions sufficiently to counter the effects of climate change. According to an analysis by the International Energy Agency, that means at least reaching global net zero emissions by 2050 on a path that's narrow but still achievable. For the past decade, that has looked frankly improbable, at least with the pace corporations were going. With the IRA, the U.S. now has a chance. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. That's gsuggsinsurance.com at 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.